Hello, I'm online. Am I just waiting?
Yep, we're going to start shortly.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to get started. So hello, everyone. Welcome to the Manitoba Bar Association's Legal Research Professional Development Webinar, Building and Maintaining a Precedence Collection. Our speaker today is John Gillies, and I'm Chelsea Tate. I'm the Member Service Coordinator of the MBA. Before we get started, I'd like to advise everyone that all phone lines are open right now to hear the presenter and to allow for questions at the end of the presentation. This means that everyone on the call, presenter and attendees alike, can hear you. So it's very important that you keep your phone lines as quiet as possible during the presentation. We ask you to press *6 to mute your line. Please don't put us on hold. We will all be able to hear any music or beeping that comes over your phone line. We will be answering questions after the presentation. If you have a question for the speaker that we would like to ask over the phone during this time, please remember to unmute your phone before the question by pressing *7. And finally, a recording of today's presentation will be available on the Legal Research Resource page of our website. Please contact the MBA if you'd like to receive a link once everything has been uploaded. And now to introduce our speaker, John Gillies. John was called to the Bar of Ontario in 1977 and has been engaged in knowledge management for almost 20 years, first as director of KM at McCarthy Tetro, then as director of practice support at Castles Brock and Blackwell, and for the last 4 years as vice president of content at KM Standards. Before entering the KM field, John had been a banking associate at McCarthy & McCarthy, as it then was, and then spent 15 years in-house with Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. With a law degree from the University of Toronto, he also holds a master's degree from Sorbonne in Paris in French corporate and commercial law. John has been a frequent speaker and writer on issues of knowledge management and legal drafting. He has spoken at the KM World Conference, as well as conferences of the International Legal Technology Association, the ARC Group, and the Canadian Bar Association. He has written on legal technology issues for SLA. Now I will turn it over to John.
Thank you. I appreciate the introduction. So I'm going to talk about precedence and also research content. I'm going to try to do this in about 45 minutes and leave 10 or 15 minutes at the end for questions. So we'll go now. I'll spend most of my time on the precedence collection, but I will also talk about research content because the two can be allied issues. So the first I'm going to talk about why you want to establish a precedence bank, and this may seem self-evident, but obviously for knowledge management issues, the primary reason is to reuse existing knowledge and to leverage the knowledge that exists already, either from your own bank of experience or from your colleagues. By having access to good quality precedents, you can start from a base and draft an agreement much better, much quicker than otherwise. There's better client service in that, in the sense, and this doesn't matter whether or not you're in a law firm or in an in-house department. Your clients are looking to you for your legal service. They're looking for quick and effective advice with quality content. So having access to good precedents will allow you to do this, and also clearly provides better training for younger lawyers. The younger lawyers are generally the ones who are tasked with providing the first draft and agreement and are almost invariably lesser experienced than whoever it is that has asked them to take on this task. So starting from a good point is going to help their training as well as advance the other issues. So there are, of course, challenges in doing this, one is devoting the necessary time. If you're doing this by committee, then, and I've had experience with this, getting everybody in the room at the right time and then to focus their attention on the necessary issues without getting distracted by tangential issues, that we say, that can itself be a challenge. You'll want to make sure that your documents cover all the necessary topics, and there, that's where the issue of tangential issues arises, because it's very important that your precedents that you have available address exactly the issues that you will encounter most of the time, and the risk is getting lost in the weeds if you have multiple variations that deal with unlikely scenarios. Gaining consensus as to substance, that's going to be one of your significant issues, because certainly in my experience, every lawyer has his or her own view as to the right way to do things. And so if you're looking for a precedent that everyone can use, you are necessarily landing upon one particular way of approaching the topic, of drafting the language, et cetera, and that's going to encounter resistance to some greater or lesser degree from people who believe that there is a better way to do it. So addressing that issue up front is something that is very important, because you need people need to have the buy-in in advance and acknowledge that this is a potential barrier, and address in advance how this is going to be dealt with, because you don't want to fight the rear guard action afterwards. I think that goes along with the last point of lawyer ego. Lawyers have take a great deal of pride in the craftsmanship for their documents, and it can be the case that asking them to do things in a way that is somewhat different or potentially significantly different from what they've done before may challenge their own sense of expertise in the particular subject area. So that's one that you're going to want to deal with. Horizontal consistency I will get into a little bit later, but I just want to flag that you'll want to make sure that once you've started drafting your precedents, they all will tend to have a similar look and feel, so that the organizational structure is going to be the same whether or not you're talking about a license agreement, a lease or whatever. And I suppose what I should stop and say here that my background is as a transactional lawyer, but the similar sort of approaches here do lend themselves to drafting litigation documents. There are the similar sort of approaches that you'll use, but my language here will be focus more on transactional documents rather than litigation documents. Right from the top, what are your goals? What are you trying to do? Because this is a project adopting basic project management principles, you'll need a project owner and a project manager, and you'll want to clarify as to what are your goals. What are you going to do? You probably will want to establish, short, medium, and long-term goals, and be detailed in that project plan, because you will want to send that out for all the interested stakeholders to see it, have their input, and get their buy-in. Because without their buy-in, your project is not going to go very far. Push on. There are four essential elements for developing a precedent initiative, and the focus tends to be on technology and using technology, but that is just one aspect of it. The first is with getting the right people with the right strategic approach and ensuring accountability. So that is very important, to make sure that if people are given tasks, it's on them to complete them in the timeline required and to own their part of the puzzle. Next is process. So you set up workflows. The idea is I would argue you don't want to just collect as many examples of a particular agreement or litigation document that you have, because you'll be drowning in data, and what you won't have is knowledge. So what you want to do is regularize and structure the content that you are going to organize. So you decide in advance what are those workflows, what are the tasks that the various members of this project are going to carry out in order to do it. Technology. Clearly, if we, my view is the more that you can use technological tools to assist you, the better your project is the more likely your project is to succeed. But you have to look realistically. Your budget constraints are obviously going to play a role. And so within the parameters of those constraints, what is it that you're going to do? How are you going to use your current technology? Are you going to buy any new tools that will help you? You want to ideally to decide that up front. And then what you want to do is to create the building blocks of your documents. What you don't want to end up with at the end is a series of standalone documents that don't talk to each other. You want the same clause to be drafted in the same way across agreements, and that is going to provide the maximum benefit to your users. These two elements are ones that I can't recommend highly enough, and that the first is not just to create but to mandate the use of a style guide. And the style guide is going to allow the users across your group, whether it's law firm or in-house department, to know that when they're drafting another agreement, what is the house style for X, Y, or Z. The document that's been my Bible for almost 10 years now is the book by Ken Adams, A Manual of Style for Contract Drafting. And it's now in its fourth edition. It is very detailed. It's 500 pages long, and it goes into great detail on all sorts of issues that you need to think about in drafting your agreement. So, for example, it's almost automatic for lawyers to add the time is of the essence clause to an agreement. So, your question should be, do we really need that clause? Well, if you go to Ken's book, you will see a very detailed discussion of that and all the reasons justifying his conclusion that no, you don't use a general clause like that. What you do is you specify what the specific deadlines are that a particular party needs to meet, and then define what the damages are if that deadline is not met. The thing about that is, obviously, if you have a larger team, it's a very extensive book. And so what you may want to do is, for general purposes, have a higher level overview of your document. On the contract standards site, there is a style guide. And parenthetically, I can provide a copy of this to the hosts and make it available, because there are hyperlinks here to some of the content. And so what the contract standards guide does, and contract standards is the sister company to my employer, CAM Standards, is provide an online guide that deals with the various issues that you want to do. Numbering of documents and various things that we'll actually get into later. The other is to appoint a general editor, and this is someone who is going to have the ultimate say as to how issues of style are going to be resolved, because there will be questions that come up from time to time in how to approach different issues. And I think what you'll see it more in is when you get suggestions from the field, say, oh, we should include this clause, that clause, the general editor can make that cutoff decision as to whether or not this is something that actually is going to be very useful for most users or is something that would really be of just limited use. But the general editor then is going to ensure that everything in your collection is going to be consistent in as much as it can be. So what I would suggest is when you start out, start with a short document. I've been involved with various projects with different law firms where they wanted essentially to boil the ocean and start with a 150-page M&A agreement and use that. Well, that's not the right way. My recommendation is start with a non-disclosure agreement because, A, it's a type of agreement that's used in basically all of the areas of your firm or your in-house department, and it has a number of clauses that you will see in other agreements, and this gives you your stakeholders a sense of what sort of document you're looking to create in the long term. So, what you want to do is prepare your first draft, and then once you've done that, you'll establish your table of contents, and my approach was to then take the table of contents and not your first draft to the subject matter experts and say to them, okay, here's the structure of the agreement, here's the content, because the titles of each of those clauses will clearly indicate what the content is, and you go to them and say, okay, is there anything that we've missed? Is there anything here that needs to be done? And that when you have that, you'll establish your bona fides, as it were, and you've got the buy-in that the approach you're taking is appropriate. Set realistic goals. This relates essentially to what you can do. If your preference is for a really, really minimalist approach, but you know that's not going to fly, well, then you need to adapt your approach accordingly. But do apply the 80-20 rule. We're not looking to a situation where I was on a precedence committee once where I remember the lawyer said, I remember one issue I encountered 15 years ago, and then the precedent had a clause that would deal with what was acknowledged to be a complete outlier situation. That's not the purpose of this endeavor. The purpose is to cover the generally recurring instances and go from there. And then, of course, you consult the actual users. And generally speaking, that's going to be the younger lawyers to start with, get their input. They're the ones who are probably in the trenches doing most of the initial drafting work and are the ones who are going to be the most likely target for your project. So my strong advice is to create precedents written in standard English. That's the phrase that Ken Adams recommends rather than plain English drafting, because that phrase has taken a certain amount of attack over the last couple of decades. But what you're doing is we are writing agreements and preparing litigation documents not for other lawyers, but for our clients to read and understand, and in particular for contracts. What you want is a document that evidences what the parties have agreed to and that they can refer to at a later time if needs be without needing legal assistance. So create it in a way so you write for your reader. And you create a clear logical structure to your document And so what that does is it, rather than having unrelated content scattered throughout the agreement, it's all in one place. There's a link there to the unified contract structure on the contract standards site, which breaks down all contract content into nine overarching categories. And what you want to do is have your agreement follow in the structure of those contracts. Use short declarative sentences. And, I mean, one example I might use is you may well have seen a document that says something like the licensor has the absolute and unfettered discretion at any time and any reason whatsoever to, you know, dot, 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 fill in the blanks. Well, that can just be done, the licensor may. And the ideal is, in my view, the shorter and clearer that the language is, the less likelihood there is for misunderstanding. One of the common arguments used against plain language drafting is that, you know, there are phrases that are used as terms of art, and there's a great deal of litigation on their meaning. Well, the reason that there's litigation is that those parties were not able to understand what their contract said and thought that it was worth paying the money to go to court. So I would suggest that the fact that there's litigation on a particularly large amounts of litigation on a particular clause shows that it is clearly it is not a clear drafting. Anyway, that's so you would eliminate superfluous language, and then create just one substantive issue per clause. You've perhaps seen clauses with the title amendment and assignment. Well, those are two separate issues that you should deal with separately. There are, you know, three or four standard alternatives for an assignment clause, and so they should be the person who is reviewing the table of contents will be able to quickly see whether or not there is or is not an assignment clause, and that, which again leads into the next one of the need for clear titles to your clauses. If you have a clear title, and you want a clear title for every substantive clause, you may have seen M&A agreements where the representations and warranties constitute maybe a third in length of the entire agreement, and simply have the title representations and warranties. Well, that doesn't allow you to know whether or not there are specific reps on, you know, go through the list, financial statements, subsidiaries, et cetera, so that's why you need them, once again, so your table of contents is a checklist as to the content. I've mentioned before about creating horizontal consistency, so all of your agreements are organized in a consistent way, so that you've got a house style. You use lots of white space, so you will have seen, I'm sure, densely packed paragraphs where you sort of little a and then a little one and then capital A, and it's all bunched into a text. What you do is you put hard returns at the end of those, which for readability purposes allows the reader to understand the flow of the text much better. And then as you get into this project, what you'll want to do is to create a base document, what I called your boilerplate agreement, that has the standard clauses. So you've got the standard approach to the introductory structure, but particularly the general provisions at the end, the notice and entire agreement, assignment, et cetera, those clauses need to be standard. And the tool that we use is able to analyze sort of thousands of agreements at a time. And what we have found over and over is that one of the clauses that has the most the widest variance in drafting is the governing law clause, and that's mainly because lawyers take an artisanal approach and want to craft each agreement so that it reflects their own personality. Well, what you want in a precedence project is standardization, and there are there's one standard governing law clause, and there may
be
one or two variations.
I'm listening it, but I'm not able to enter to the webinar. I'm not able to view it. Okay, fine. Thank you.
Sorry.
Just a reminder to everybody on the phone, please press star 6 as we can hear background noise.
So then once you've succeeded in starting your library, creating a number of these documents, what you obviously want to do is to make your collection accessible. And the ideal way to do that is to use a hyperlinked index. And what that then does is allows you to give sort of different titles to agreements. That's perhaps less obvious here than in we'll talk in research content. But some people, for example, will search non-disclosure agreements. Others will search confidentiality agreements. And you want users to be able to find your agreements. So that's going to be a technology issue. What sort of technology do you have? Maybe this is on your intranet, if you have one, or on your document management system. But that's you want to make sure that users find it easy to get to these documents. You want to have an owner for each of your agreements, so that's the person who that's the subject matter expert whom the editor is going to discuss the issues with as they arise for that agreement, and the substantive decisions are up to the subject matter expert, but the all the other issues of form, et cetera, are going to be by the editor. So, and what I have seen as the major problem with precedence initiatives once they've gotten up and going is that they are then not continued, and you need to keep your agreements up to date. And I know of one firm where they had a precedence committee, and when they pulled up their trust agreement to review, and it had not been reviewed in 18 years. Well, that's what that means is people will no longer have confidence in an agreement that is obviously that old. So what you need to do is you need to encourage feedback and make the commenting easy. And then once somebody has made a suggestion, you want to get back and provide an answer one way or the other. There's some way of acknowledging contributions, ideally in the text of the agreement, and that will then give added oomph to your agreement if other members on the particular team see that so-and-so, such and such a lawyer has recommended the addition of this clause. That then gives that lawyer's imprimatur at least to that clause and by extension to the agreement itself. And users should know the last date that it was updated, because they want to know how current it is. That is definitely going to be an issue. If there have been changes in the law and your agreement has not been updated since that, your users are not going to go to this, which means then that you're going to need a process to update your agreement. There needs to be some sort of diary system. And even if there are no actual changes to the agreement, then you update it with the current date to indicate that it has been that has been done, and then let everybody know that you've done the update, so that once again the users know that this is something that you are keeping up. So that is what I wanted to talk about precedence, and I hope you will have questions about that. So now I want to turn to the effective management of research content. And so here what I would envisage as there being two general categories of content, one being research memos and the other being court documents, which could be copies of jurisprudence, factums, et cetera, et cetera. So that the research memos are probably internally generated, and the court documents are externally generated. So that what that means is that you've got a potential technological issue as that will affect retrievability, because as I'm sure you know, imaged PDFs are not searchable. So the metadata, that the title and any other information that is in the metadata will be available, but if users are searching, they will not find the content in any imaged PDFs. And now, more and more PDFs these days are likely to be properly scanned and searchable, but certainly older content may well be imaged PDFs. So what I'm going to talk about here is the properly tagging your content and using an effective taxonomy to structure your content and make it available via multiple access points. So I think it's fairly obvious that there are two ways that people find content, namely searching and browsing. Excuse me. While there are people who tend to prefer one way rather than the other, users do use both, and so you will you obviously need to ensure that the content that you have is accessible either by search or by browsing. So when you're talking about search, if your firm or department is able to afford it, an enterprise search engine is the ideal way to go, not just for this content, but for any of the content in the document management system. It is an expensive tool, though, and there are many, many firms and departments who don't have enterprise search. So that would be the gold standard. So assuming you don't have enterprise search, then search can be more of a hit and miss. You are relying on either a document management system, if you have one, or if you're simply relying on a Windows folder structure, that makes the searching even more of a challenge. As even if you have a document management system, I know from personal experience that there can often happen that there's content that you know is there. You enter the proper search terms and the search result comes up empty because there's some issue that you can't identify that is veiling that content from you. So in the ideal way to do that is to have your proper tagging of your content, so to make it more easy to find. When you're talking browsing, as you know, it's the standard browse is a nested folder structure, so users are familiar with that approach. If your documents are in a Windows or Microsoft standard folder structure, the problem is that the particular file lives in one and only one location. So when you're browsing, there are different ways of conceiving of the same sort of content. And so different users have a different conceptual approach. So if your taxonomy and the taxonomy, the fancy word for folder structure to organize content. If the taxonomy does not make it obvious for one user that a particular content is located elsewhere, that is going to challenge the users. So what you want to do is to have an effective taxonomy and content that you can access from different locations, and there ideally you're going to get a hyperlinked index to this content, and that is going to significantly increase the likelihood that your users are going to find the right content. So for search, what you want to do is have a single controlled list of tags. So once again, you'll want an editor here who is in charge of the tags that are used. You can, in addition to that, depending on the technology that you use, create a synonym ring. So in the example that I used a little bit earlier, if somebody searches confidentiality agreement, then if you have a tool that makes use of a synonym ring, that the tool can then also search other content that's tagged with NDA, non-disclosure agreement, or any of the other variations. So that is going to increase your user's likelihood of finding the right content. For browsing, what you want to do is to develop a single standard text taxonomy for classifying your content. And there are a couple of general rules for establishing a good taxonomy, and that is that you don't want more than 10, and ideally only 7 categories per level. And the reason for that is that if you have, let's say, 25 different folders under a subfolders under a general folder, the user is may well say, okay, well, it could be here, or could be there, or could be there, and would be forced to sort of go down each rabbit hole, as it were, trying to see whether or not the particular route is the happy one. When you have about 7 topics, then it should be clear to the user that, okay, it's clearly here because it doesn't fall there. What that means is your topics should not include the term general. And I know that's a challenge, but the risk is that far too much content ends up being placed in general because of a hesitation of locating it properly. As long as the content is properly tagged and you've got effective ways to find it, that should not be a problem. So what you want to do then is publish your taxonomy on the intranet, if that's what you can do, with a hyperlinked index, which will then allow people to find what they need. So I'll get back to the same issue I had before, which is it's very important to have a general editor with the sole responsibility for curating the tag list and synonym ring. When I was in CIBC, one of the things I did was I was in charge of the group that handled inquiries from the various branches, and so we developed a taxonomy of content. I didn't know that the taxonomy was the term at the time, and that's what we were able to use. And when people had similar issues, we would go to the taxonomy and find what we had done before and use that. And so what we did was we standardized the process for tagging and taxonomizing. The one thing that I didn't do, but at that time, because I was making it up as I went along, was to develop a statement of principles as to how the tags are applied and updated. So that's very useful because the others who use the tags want to know about that. So what I'd suggest with this content is start with a small area, and Maybe it's municipal law, maybe it's constructive dismissal, that depends on what your particular area is. And with that way you can make your small mistakes and learn from them, and then slowly widen the scope to that. Okay, if it's just municipal law, then go a little bit wider to commercial leases or constructive dismissal to severance or whatever, and then you go even broader. And those you're going to learn as you go. And as you make mistakes, which inevitably you will, you document the lessons learned and the principles applied. So that's going to be very, very useful for you later, because what you'll find is that the approach that you use to resolve one issue is actually going to be very similar, if not identical, to what you do in a perhaps seemingly entirely different context. And there we are. So if you are interested, there is on contractstandards.com, there are hundreds of freely available contracts and clauses which are available for your use. And I realize now I should, there's one point about Ken Adams' book, which is relevant here, which is Ken's book is written by an American lawyer for predominantly American content, but the issues that he raises are substantive issues, and there are very few instances that I've encountered where the Canadian law is so different than that Ken's advice does not apply. So clearly employment law issues are going to vary, but in all sorts of other issues, what you're talking about is how to draft properly a clause that deals with a particular issue. Well, the deal of the licensor's grant of a license, for example, those issues are going to be the same on either side of the border. There's my email address if you would like to contact me. So thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
There was a question on the chat from Melanie. It's, do you recommend the use of Wiki alongside an internal precedent database, SharePoint, or something else?
I think the question as to which technology tool is going to your IT colleagues are going to have the most input as to what works with them. I have not actually used a wiki, so I must say I don't have any personal experience. I do have colleagues here in Toronto at law firms who have used it successfully, wikis used to be very leading edge about 10 years ago, but one doesn't read a lot about wiki use these days. As to SharePoint, if your organization has SharePoint, then that would obviously be a logical way to go, because you want to use the same platform that your colleagues are using. That you want to make sure that you are front and center in their mind when they go to a particular area. So if you have an intranet, if the link to your contracts is on the landing page of your intranet, then that's going to be good news. But it's really in consultation with your IT professionals, the determination as to what the right platform is.
Thanks. There's also a question on tech recommendations for contract management.
Right. I must be frank. I'm not as familiar with other tools as I am with the tool that KM Standards use. If you wanted to go to KMStandards.com, there is another tool called Kira, K-I-R-A. Its use is analyzing documents in a due diligence context. So they will pull out all the relevant clauses that you would want to know in due diligence. But I I admit that I'm not as familiar. I honestly don't know whether there are other tools that do something similar to the one that KM Standards does. And I see that there's a next question about who in the firm works as the editor. I've always worked closely with my colleagues in the library, and the librarians are trained to be information management experts. To be frank, going back to the issue of lawyer ego, it's also been my experience that in many cases, and this may be more in law firms than in law departments, that lawyers tend to not to value as much the contributions of anyone who's not a lawyer. And so you've got a political issue of if you have someone who's not a lawyer who's in charge of making these decisions, are those decisions going to be adopted and accepted by your lawyer base? So that would be a decision that you would make in your particular environment. As to how time-consuming, that's again going to depend upon the scope of your project, and it will obviously be most time-consuming in the initial stages when you are determining what you need to do and making those initial decisions. In principle, over time, that time should reduce, but there will be time that will be needed in order to do this properly. And again, if you're talking a law firm environment, the reality is that this is non-billable time, and the pressure is on law firm lawyers to increase their billable time. The question is suggestions on starting a taxonomy, the abridgment, the CED, Carswell's. I don't have any specific suggestions. I think what you do is you find out whether there are any taxonomies that your particular lawyer group uses, and you may find. I know that there are in litigation there are a taxonomy for docketing codes, I believe, and so if your firm is using that taxonomy, then maybe that is a proper way to start. But what you want to do is attune it to the actual needs of your users. And so it might well be a launch pad, but it's one that you want to tailor to their particular needs.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you. This is a real challenge, and I'd be very frank on the contract drafting side. I will say that you should expect the more of a plain language approach that you take, the more initial pushback you are likely to get from the more seasoned practitioners, which is why if you can bring the clients into the equation and let the clients see the draft, that's obviously an easier proposition in an in-house environment where you want to work closely with your clients, but that's a threshold issue that you're going to have to deal with, and the general feeling is that if it's short and blunt, as it were, lawyers will tend to have an initial reaction as, oh, well, this can't possibly cover everything that it needs to, and so there is an educational function that's involved in trying to walk the people through. So then what that means is that you yourself have to have the be acknowledged by those potential users that you have something to say that they should listen to. So how you get them to do that, that's an interesting challenge.
And will we be able to get a copy of the PowerPoint from you, too?
Oh, absolutely.
Put on the website? Okay, great, thanks.
Absolutely.
Okay, it looks like that's all the questions, so thank you for speaking in the webinar today.
And you're welcome.
We did record this, so it will go up on the website, the legal research resources page of the website, along with the PowerPoint. So.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.